From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how's Mike Duggan done in his first 6 months as Detroit's mayor?
Things aren't right in the city yet, and they couldn't possibly be in a city like Detroit in 6 months.
But is there progress to report? We find out. Plus, what can Michigan learn from Minnesota?
They have never had a month with double-digit unemployment going back until at least 1976.
Why a leading surgeon worries about his Medicaid patients.
Medicaid-insured patients had twice the number of complications, twice the incidence of complications as the privately insured.
And summer camp for adults.
What we're doing is trying to get people outside and reacquainted with nature and away from the smartphones and tablets and laptops and things like that.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Here in Michigan, cutting taxes is thought to be the way to revive the state's economy, and we're not alone.
For so long, the accepted formula is that in order to have a healthy state economy, you have to have low taxes and low spending and right-to-work laws.
Bucking the trend, Minnesota's economy. That state raised taxes on the wealthy and businesses and invested even more in public services. And of all of our Great Lakes neighbors, they have the lowest unemployment rate. That's according to a recent study done by the nonpartisan think tank Michigan Future. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, report author Rick Haglund will join us and help us sort out just what Michigan might learn from Minnesota. That story later this hour. But first, Mike Duggan set out a challenge when he was sworn in as mayor of Detroit. Watch what happens in 6 months. Well, we're nearly at that six-month mark. All this week, the Detroit Journalism Cooperative will take the mayor up on his offer. They are going to look at the changes in Detroit over these past 6 months, see how the city is functioning under bankruptcy, and what better place to start than with Mike Duggan himself. We're joined now by Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick and Michigan Radio's Lester Graham of Michigan Watch. Lester, I want to start with you. What are the reviews like for Mike Duggan's first 6 months?
Well, one of the things that I was told was that City Hall for the first time has a mayor who will check up on them, make sure that they're doing the work that they should be. And it's kind of amazing because he's showing some real leadership skills for a guy who really has been elected to serve a city without any power. Remember, the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, is in charge of whatever goes on in the city, and the only power that Mayor Duggan gets is the power that the emergency manager is willing to share.
But there was a degree, and I bet you saw this too, Sarah, as Mayor Duggan comes in, a degree of, wasn't it kind of horse trading with Kevin Orr as far as how much he was going to get to run and how much Orr was going to give him?
Yeah, during the campaign, Mike Duggan had talked a lot about being involved in the bankruptcy, Detroit's bankruptcy process, and just, you know, being aggressive with Kevin Orr on a number of important issues. But almost immediately after he got into office, they signed a power-sharing agreement. And, you know, Duggan has mostly been running most of the city's day-to-day operations. And as Lester said, he's been very hands-on about it. And Orr is managing the bankruptcy side of things. And Duggan really hasn't inserted himself much into that process at all.
Is it safe to say that these are two guys, Orr and Duggan, who get each other? They understand each other?
I think they do. At first, it seemed that relations between the two of them might be a little frosty. An interesting side note, I believe they went to the University of Michigan Law School together. Going forward, things seem to sort of have thawed very quickly, and now I get the impression that they work together pretty well and seem to have a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, it seems they have some of the same goals in mind. There is some tension there, and Duggan often will make little jokes at the emergency manager's expense in some of these public addresses when Kevin Orr is sitting there in the audience. So little digs here and there, but I think overall they know they have to deal with each other, and Duggan's just hoping he doesn't have to deal with Orr any longer than absolutely necessary.
Well, he's made that very clear, that he expects Orr to hit the highway come September. What do observers see as his successes? What is Mike Duggan doing right?
Well, you know, he said he couldn't fix everything in 6 months.
But 6 months from now, you're going to be able to judge for yourself whether the leadership of this city has a sound plan and is achieving it.
And so that plan's been laid out pretty clearly. He's going to be dealing with blight. He's going to be dealing with people who are trying to streamline this area. So he's had the blight task force mm-hmm. at work. They're making progress there. He's been pressuring the Public Lighting Authority to get plenty of streetlights up and running. They've been doing that. They've been looking he's been pressuring the director of the Department of Transportation to get the buses going, get more buses on the road. They've been working on that. So there's a lot of stuff that is happening. And, you know, I think the people are seeing some of that, recognizing some of that. His honeymoon period is gone at least 6 months.
I largely agree with that. I think that Duggan has been very visible in a way that the prior mayor, Dave Bing, was really not. And obviously, the mayor before that, Kwame Kilpatrick, had a whole host of issues he had to deal with in the latter years of being mayor. And I do think that, you know, he really does have a knack for actually kind of interacting with and talking to people. So I think while there remain sort of a few people in the communities who are a little suspicious of him, I think he's managed to build a pretty good rapport with most of his constituents.
Yeah, it's amazing because here's a guy who's basically a suburbanite, a white mayor in a town that's 80% African-American, and he knows he's got to be among the people to kind of make connection there. So he doesn't dress like some of our past mayors. He's a little, you know, casual about his dress. He drives himself around. He stops in the neighborhoods. He talks with people because he wants to be seen as a regular guy. And he's not running around with, you know, in the past, you mm-hmm. know, five bodyguards and an entourage. He's just out there on his own.
And so when you talk to people in Detroit, what are you hearing?
Most of them like him.
Just in the short amount of time he had, he done did a lot. Can't even put nothing past Mike Duggan. You know, that's like the best man ever, man, you know, as far as mayor.
Everything improved. He doing his job, put it that way.
Duggan, man!
You're a fan of the mayor, then?
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Sarah, what do you think are the things that are really beyond Mike Duggan's control that might need to be factored in when you judge whether or not he's been a success?
Well, obviously the bankruptcy. He doesn't have much of any control over that process. And the issue of schools. Duggan has undertaken a whole bunch of initiatives to improve quality of life in the city and try to attract new residents to the city. Probably the biggest project he's launched so far is his effort to rehab some of the vacant homes, city-owned vacant homes that are in decent shape, and use an online auction to attract buyers. And that so far seems to have been pretty successful, although it's been a pretty short amount of time since it started. But Detroit schools are still a key issue, and in terms of attracting more residents to the city, that's a huge concern, obviously, for families with children, and he doesn't really have any control over that at all. He's said he wants to be a partner with DPS and do sort of joint initiatives with them, but in terms of the direction of the schools, Detroit Public Schools are under a state emergency manager, and he doesn't really have any control over the other schools out there either.
The other thing he's itching to get a hold of is he's not in charge of the police department. Kevin Orr is in charge of the police department, and crime is the other big issue. Schools and crime are the two major issues that people think of in Detroit, and he doesn't have any say in either of those right now.
Was it a mistake to set out that six-month challenge, do you think?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think the mayor, well, he'll address this, and I think he's got a lot to show, a lot that's done, or at least a lot that's on its way to, you know, improving. Things aren't right in the city yet, and they couldn't possibly be in a city like Detroit in 6 months. But he can show progress and a trend line, and he's a big metrics guy, so a trend line is a good thing.
What do you think, Sarah?
I don't think it was a mistake. I mean, I think people have a sense that things are moving in the right direction just in terms of the overall structure of city government and services and those sorts of things. Moving forward, they have a sense that he's more involved, that things are a little bit more organized, that kind of sense. I mean, I think if services like the bus system, for example, really continue to be a chronic problem and he can't get a handle on that, that will become an issue at some point. But I think 6 months down the line, I think people are pretty optimistic about things. And I think they're willing to give him a little bit more time to really show the changes that he'll make.
Well, that's a good look at the mayor, at Mike Duggan. Lester, what's ahead this week for your reports for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative?
Well, we're going to be looking at his efforts at blight. We're going to be looking at mass transit, see how many buses are actually getting out on the street. We're going to look at this lighting, street lights, which is a big issue for the neighborhoods. Sarah Hewlett will be doing a feature on crime and what's happening in Detroit. And Sarah Swick's going to be looking at schools.
A busy, busy week, and these reports will be airing on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Lester Graham, Sarah Swick, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does it mean when a county ranks number 5 in the state for access to health services, but dead last, 82nd out of 82 counties in health behaviors, and 64th out of 82 counties in health outcomes? That's a puzzle that public health officials in Muskegon County are trying to solve. Now, getting to a healthcare professional seems to be happening in Muskegon, but when you're last in the state in terms of smoking, drinking, STDs, teen pregnancy, and obesity, there's a disconnect somewhere. Thus, a health initiative happening in Muskegon that could hold lessons for the rest of Michigan. It's called One in 21. Joining us is Linda Juarez, who is co-chair of the One in 21 Health Campaign, as well as the CEO of Hackley Community Care Center. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
And the director of public health for Muskegon County is joining us, Ken Krause. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
The idea, Ken Krause, as director of public health, is to do what? When we talk about this 1 in 21 initiative, what are you trying to get people to commit to do?
We're trying to get them to commit to changing something in their personal life, their family life, their work life, their community life, to move us more towards health and more away from things that make us unwell. And there's lots of things that people can do, and what we're seeing is lots of people and organizations doing it. So, you know, can we get our cities and townships to commit to complete streets to make the environment more walkable and inviting for people to get active? Can we get the schools to take a look at things like their lunch menus or organizing kids to participate in running activities and those sorts of things? Can we organize our businesses to engage in say bike to work weeks and those sorts of things? So it's looking at how do we get people to think of what can you do rather than try to tell them what to do?
Yeah.
And you know, the culture changes to, you know, if we you know, consciously focus on the kinds of things that we can do and we take action on it, that's where you begin to see culture changing. And, you know, what we're trying to do is make the norm more thinking about what can I do that's going to be healthier, or make the healthy choice the easier choice than just to sort of, you know, continue floating down this lazy river that's going to cause us more and more heartache and people dying earlier and feeling miserable for their life.
We're speaking about the health initiative happening right now in Muskegon called One in 21. The goal is to take them from dead last as far as health behaviors, dead last, 82nd out of 82 counties, and get them up to number one by 2021. We're talking with the director of public health for Muskegon County, Ken Krause, and Linda Juarez, who is co-chair of the One in 21 health campaign. Does this take a lot of funding, Linda?
We've done it with very little funding. All the partner agencies have leaned in with some support, financial support, but our purpose is not to create a new organization, have a costly infrastructure. It's to really build on those activities and initiatives that currently occur in Muskegon County and to create the synergy between them. It's that synergy that we're going for that will change the culture.
And the initiative launched in...
Money's good, so if you know of money, we'll...
You're happy to take some. and the initiative launched in 2011. I'm wondering, have you been able to measure any impact so far?
What we landed on was that the health rankings. You know, once Linda mm-hmm. mentioned that, you know, we discovered if we're going to make the change, the only thing we have to do is change everything. And the best measure of everything related to health was the county health rankings. And we this year have begun to see a little bit of a turn more toward the direction we want to go. So, you know, it took a while to sort of organize ourselves and think of how do we organize people to get the word out. How do we try and drum up maybe events that sort of focus the attention on this effort, and how do we try to engage people to do that? So, as Linda was saying, we took. You know, we've got activities that were going on in the community, and they've folded into one in 21. For instance, the Bike to Work Week, and a lot of focus on employers there. We've got the school group came up with a eating an apple challenge, and actually the country of New Zealand challenged us, and so we challenged them back and beat them. They beat our record, and we beat their record. So apparently we've got a Guinness World Book record of everybody eating apples at the same time.
Okay.
but it's to focus the attention on that.
When I looked on the 1 in 21 website, I saw a lot of things about the different groups involved, community involvement in schools and business involvement. I saw helpful tips. And I wondered to myself, if you are on that website exploring these things, aren't you someone who's already health conscious? So in essence, are you preaching to the choir? How do you reach the people who are caught up in these unhealthy behaviors, who would not think to click on that website or, let's say, join the 21,000-pound Muskegon Weight Loss Challenge? How do you reach them, Linda?
Well, we reach them. We serve between 16,000 and 18,000 people through our center, who are low-income residents of our community. When we run our stats on our patient population, then for obesity, about half of our patient population is obese. Our smoking rates are about 10% higher than the community rate. So we know that issues of poverty are affected more adversely. So the way that people who may not be health conscious, for example, our patient population, mm-hmm. Can be addressed through their providers, through their physician, or who they go to for that. Remember, we're really good on access to health care. So using that health care infrastructure to really educate and coach people to live healthier lives. The other way we get at that is through our community engagement subcommittee. Where do they church? Where is their neighborhood association? Who are their neighbors? And really starting to promote cooking classes and education and coaching, again, through those non-healthcare, non-traditional avenues as well. That's how we get to the people who haven't heard a message or haven't even realized they're interested or how they may fit in.
And Ken Krause is Director of Public Health for Muskegon County. I'm sure that your counterparts all over Michigan are wrestling with that dilemma. Can you get people to make those little changes and get enough of them to do it to move the meter and improve the overall health of a county?
Well, we know that those changes can occur, but you know it takes an ongoing multi-level sort of focus and encouragement. I mean, these are lifelong habits for a lot of these people. For instance, where Linda's talking about with her patients, the large group that we have that we can most directly engage in, what I've challenged my staff to do, is we have the WIC program, the Women, Infant, and Children Nutrition Program. And roughly half the women and children 5 and under in our community participate in that program. And we've found that 28% of the pregnant women that participate in our WIC program smoke during their pregnancy. So we've got, the substance abuse prevention program has been challenged with coming up with interventions to try and work with that group with regard to reducing the smoking. So that's getting underway. The WIC staff has also been challenged with putting together some projects to sort of focus on the 14% of 3- and 4-year-olds who are already in the obese range. And how do we help those families not only to focus on the nutrition side of it, but on some physical activity side of it? So, they're putting together activities to engage those families around some very specific issues related to their health and a couple of the most troubling of our health behavior statistics.
Last thoughts. What can the rest of Michigan learn from 1 in 21 from this effort, Linda?
I think the number one thing, as you said, do we have a lot of resources in this community to do this? Don't wait for a big corporation to give you a lot of money, or a foundation, or the federal government, or the state government. Begin now, because healthcare is the foundation for economic development and educational attainment. And if we don't do it now, our generations and generations ahead of us will suffer.
Ken Krause?
I think that it's the focus on getting as many people engaged in looking for those organizations that are willing to partner. For us, I really believe that the Rotary connection made all the difference. It's not the first time we've tried to do something, but it's a place where we can connect with a lot more people from a lot of different areas that engages a wider range of interest. So, I think looking for much more broadly for people who aren't necessarily, working in a health-related field, but they have interest in it.
Ken Krause, Director of Public Health for Muskegon County, joined by Linda Juarez, who is co-chair of the 1 in 21 Health Campaign. Thanks to both of you, and good luck with 1 in 21.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
For many kids in Michigan, summertime means camp. Whether it's day camp or, if you're lucky, sleepaway camp, kids can get to step away from their usual routines, get outdoors. All too often, those usual routines involve staring at some sort of a screen. The Michigan DNR and Michigan Recreation and Park Association have decided it isn't just our children who need a healthy dose of summertime outdoor fun. Adults are just as much in need of ditching their smartphones and tablets and laptops and getting reacquainted with Mother Nature. So the DNR and MRPA have created summer camp for adults called Camp Kid Again. Stephanie Wirtz is with the Outdoor Recreation and Event Coordinator for Saginaw County. Camp K-I-T-I-G-I-N, Kid Again. That's a great name, Stephanie. Just what is this camp?
Camp Kid Again is a chance for adults to get outside and be a kid again. We're going to have this camp, and it, like you said, it is going to be screen-free. So what we're doing is trying to get people outside and reacquainted with nature and away from the smartphones and tablets and laptops and things like that.
So you are really literally opening up YMCA's Camp Timbers in West Branch for a couple of weekends in August and September. Adults, and the idea is keep your smartphone. What, are you going to take them away? I think it's hilarious. It's great. It's badly needed.
It is, actually. I'm guilty myself. I'm very much looking forward to this. What we're actually going to do is recommend that they leave them behind in their vehicles, at home, however they want to do that. And then what we'll do is when people get there, what people do nowadays is document things.
Yeah.
And we're going to still provide that opportunity to document things. We are going to provide you with a journal and a disposable camera. So you can still take your pictures. You can still write about what you want to write about. But we'll just be doing it kind of old school instead of updating our Facebook or taking pictures with our smartphones, things like that. So we're going to kind of do different things to kind of get back to the way it used to be.
And what kinds of activities will be offered?
Oh, we have lots of things that are going to be offered up there. We have fishing, kayaking. There's opportunities for hikes, campfires, zip lining. There's beach volleyball, other kinds of sporting activities. Just whatever kids do at camp, the adults are going to have that same opportunity.
I am interested. Are you getting inquiries from singles or are couples saying, hey, honey, let's go do this camp weekend?
It's actually a little bit of both. We've had people contact us that, you know, they're couples or groups of friends that want to get away. We've also had, you know, groups of women that want to get together and get away. We've had groups of men. It's just kind of, it's been a mix. A lot of people have shown a lot of interest in it, which is very good for us because, you know, we want to get people outside and we want to get them excited about being outside again. So
well,
that's
one
perfect way to do it.
One thing I doubt you hear from the children, but you probably will be hearing from adults. What are the cabins like? What are the sleeping accommodations like?
Yep. Well, at Camp Timbers, they have separate cabins. The cabins sleep 10 campers, and there are male cabins and there are female cabins. We don't discourage sneaking out after hours, so you can do that. but there will be cabins available, and, you know, it's like you would when you were at summer camp. You'd bring your sheets and you bring everything that you need for your camp, and when you walk into your cabin, you have a bed. And that's about it. So you bring everything you need for camp, and, yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Camp Timbers is a phenomenal facility. If anybody hasn't been there, you should check it out online or call the YMCA and see if you can get a chance to go check it out. Because, I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful facility.
What are the rewards, do you think, or what do you hope people will get out of a few days of zip lining and swimming and kayaking and not smartphoning everything and being on their laptops?
Yeah. Well, what I'm hoping is that people can take that chance to reconnect with nature and look at how wonderful Michigan is. I mean, the DNR has many, many wonderful state parks. MRPA is their member organizations have many, many different places that you can go to enjoy the outdoors. And sometimes we get so busy that we forget about what's actually out there and how beautiful our state really is and how much it has to offer. And so I'm hoping that by getting out there and getting people into this camp, that they'll kind of remember, you know, what the state is all about and what our natural resources really have to provide for them.
And I trust there will be campfire songs?
Absolutely.
Stephanie Wirtz is with the Saginaw County Parks and Recreation Department. Camp Kittigan is happening August 15th through the 17th and again September 12th to the 14th at the YMCA Camp Timbers in West Branch. Registration for Camp Kittigan is $200 and the proceeds help fund youth athletic programs all throughout Michigan. Stephanie, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Yep, thank you so much.
Still to come, how did Minnesota grow its economy and get so far ahead of where we are in Michigan?
They have never had a month with double-digit unemployment going back until at least 1976.
That story is up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Michigan keeps trying to climb back out of the huge hole that was the Great Recession, a new report suggests we might want to take a closer look at one of our Great Lakes neighbors, Minnesota. A new study done for the nonpartisan think tank Michigan Future examines the policies, priorities, and economies of Michigan and Minnesota. And since Minnesota has the best economy in the Great Lakes region, it's worth trying to figure out just what they're doing right and what Michigan might learn from that. Business writer Rick Hagland authored the report. Welcome back, Rick.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
When we look at Minnesota, what do we see?
We see a state that has the best economy in the Great Lakes region, and one of the best economies in the country. It's been ranked in the top 10 for employment growth, the unemployment rate, personal income for many years. So it has one of the best economies in the country. Curiously, it's also a very high tax and high spending state. For so long the accepted formula is that in order to have a healthy state economy, you have to have low taxes and low spending and right to work laws. Minnesota actually has turned all of that on its head. And it's a very interesting case study.
Before we get into the high tax and high spending approach, give us a sense of what Minnesota has in terms of per capita income and in unemployment, because I guess that will help us see where Michigan stands compared to Minnesota.
Sure. Back in 1990, Minnesota and Michigan were roughly comparable in per capita income. And since that time, we're at a point where Minnesota's per capita income is nearly $9,000 a person higher than in Michigan. The latest unemployment rate, it's 4.7% in Minnesota. They have never had a month with double-digit unemployment going back until at least 1976. And maybe as important as the unemployment rate, maybe even more so, is the fact that Minnesota has one of the highest percentages of adults in the labor force in the country. Michigan has one of the lowest. So the spread is pretty wide.
When you talk about the reason behind that and talk about the fact that Minnesota is high tax and high spending, spell out some of those differences for us in terms of taxes, because I guess what we're looking at income and business and sales and gasoline.
Correct. And one of the things I would say is that it's difficult to say that that high taxes and high spending are the cause of Michigan or of Minnesota's good economy, and we really aren't saying that.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying that these are underlying policies that Minnesotans have enacted decades ago and believe contribute to their healthy economy. But it's difficult to prove causation. They also have a pretty rich mix of industries. They're less dependent on one industry. They have a diverse economy, less dependent on one industry than we are here in Michigan.
Right.
But in terms of tax rates, on the personal income side, they have long had a progressive income tax system where those who make the most money pay a bigger portion of their income. Their top income tax rate is 9.85%. And even people on the low end are paying 5.35%. Michigan has one rate, as you know, and it's 4.25%. So personal income taxes are quite a bit higher. The corporate income tax rate is about a third higher than Michigan's. It's 9.8%. Michigan's is 6%. And unlike in Michigan, all of the businesses in Minnesota pay at least something through a minimum fee. In Michigan, the only ones that pay the corporate income tax are C corporations, which generally have stockholders. They have their gasoline tax is 9 cents a gallon higher than in Michigan. The sales tax rate is 6.85%, and local jurisdictions can add up to a percentage point on the sales tax. So their tax rates are quite a bit higher than Michigan's.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with business writer Rick Hagland, who did a very, very in-depth report comparing the economies, the policies, and the priorities of Michigan and Minnesota, with Minnesota having the best economy in the Great Lakes, in fact, one of the best economies in the nation. Rick, it does cost more to live in Minnesota. What do Minnesotans get for those higher taxes?
Well, they get a pretty good education system. They have problems in some of their urban school districts, much like Michigan does. But overall, they've led the nation for a number of years in terms of the percentage of students who are considered college ready by the ACT folks. They also have, a fine public, higher education system, as we do as well. But they have one of the highest, I think, well, they do have the highest percentage of college graduates in the Great Lakes region and one of the highest in the country. The other thing that's kind of interesting I found was that they have a very strong social safety net. One of the things that many states, including Michigan, have done has taken the tack that in order to get people in the workforce, you've got to make it, less lucrative for them to stay on welfare and unemployment benefits. And Minnesota does exactly the opposite. They have a very strong budget, high budget for health and human services. And on the unemployment side, the maximum weekly benefit for people who are unemployed is $610 a week. In Michigan, it's $362 a week. Mm-hmm. But yet they have a much lower unemployment rate than in Michigan. So Minnesotans get a lot for the money they pay in taxes.
Transportation infrastructure is a very sore spot with so many Michiganders right now, especially seeing legislators adjourning for the summer and not approving any package of bills to put money toward, any significant money anyway, toward repairing our roads. And when you find that Michigan spent $223 per capita on transportation, Minnesota more than $500 per resident. They've got light rail, right, and connecting the capital to the suburbs. They've been boosting road funding. It does make you kind of cast an envious eye over at the state of Minnesota.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I should point out that, if Michigan were just simply to adopt everything that Minnesota's doing today, we probably wouldn't get, the same results at least anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Minnesota has really been doing this for decades. They go back into the 1970s, where they enacted something that became known as the Minnesota Miracle. And basically what it was they shifted the burden of taxation away from local taxes to state taxes. People were really having a difficult time paying the property taxes on their homes and businesses, and the state basically said, the state as a whole needs to pick up more of that burden. And they ended up setting policies that really became important to economic growth, and it's something that they've done for 40 years, and it's basically lasted throughout, various Republican and Democratic administrations. They haven't swung wildly from one set of priorities to the next as they elect a new governor or a new legislature. They've stayed the course for a long time.
And the rewards are now reaped. There they are. And we do hear Governor Snyder consistently, touting his policies of tightening spending and cutting taxes for business as the way to revive Michigan's economy. When you really do that study, Rick, and hold it up to what's working in Minnesota, what do you think of that?
You're right that the governor and the legislature, which is controlled by the Republican Party, are, advocates of low taxes. But on the other hand, if you look at what Michigan has been doing as the economy has improved, I mean, we're also saying, hey, education's important, K-12's important, early childhood's important, higher ed's important, transportation is important. And on many of those things, we're devoting more resources to those things again. I think there's a recognition in Michigan among the politicians and amongst the citizenry that, some of these investments are important to a healthy economy, and we should be doing them.
Business writer Rick Hagland, who authored a new study done for the nonpartisan think tank Michigan Future, examining the economies of Michigan and Minnesota. Thanks so much, Rick. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Cindy.
It was an important day for many in Michigan, April 1st, the day nearly 500,000 people in our state became newly eligible for the expanded Medicaid program. Since Michigan opened those Medicaid doors April 1st, more than 300,000 people have enrolled. Many have not seen a physician in a long time. They've relied on emergency rooms for their medical care. As revealed in a study published in the medical group JAMA Surgery, there is some challenging news in all of this. Certainly, it is good patients will be able to turn to a physician or a surgeon for medical care. But the challenge is the overall poor health of so many of these patients, especially the surgical patients, and that has many implications to the patients, to the hospitals, and to the surgeons who treat them. Joining me now is the leader of that new study. He is the chief medical officer of the University of Michigan Health System, and he is a surgeon, Dr. Daryl Campbell, Jr. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
You analyzed data on some 14,000 patients and who had had operations in 52 hospitals in Michigan from July 2012 to June 2013. What did you find?
Well, we were particularly interested in looking at the Medicaid population and comparing them to folks that have private insurance but are approximately the same age. And we were wondering what kind of shape they were in prior to their surgical procedure. And what we found was that they weren't in very good shape. And that has consequences for the results after they have surgery, and not only in terms of how well they do from a physical point of view, but also the costs and resources that are used afterwards.
Give us an idea. When you say not in very good shape, what kinds of conditions were they suffering from? And I take it this was a large percentage. Can you give us some idea?
Yeah, well, for instance, twice as many folks that were covered by Medicaid smoke as folks that are privately insured, and that has implications for how whether they get pneumonia after surgery or not. So just in that one example, you can see that there's a problem there.
And what does this mean in terms of outcome, first of all, surgical outcome and mortality?
Well, there were actually quite a significant difference. The Medicaid-insured patients had twice the number of complications, twice the incidence of complications as the privately insured folks, and serious, when we looked at serious complications, there was two-thirds more serious complications after surgery and more than twice the chance of dying from surgery, actually.
Is this something that, Doctor, you think we'll see? Here we are at the beginning, so we're at the kind of the forefront of this expansion. So you're seeing more low-income people get health care through Medicaid in Michigan coming into the system. As that happens, do you expect this will get better as people get into the system and get primary care physicians to treat them?
I think so. And I think the more we can get people into a structured medical system, the more we can interact and intervene to make their health a little bit better prior to a big surgical procedure. If we can do that, the results will be better.
What do you hope will happen from this study that you've done and this data that you have found about the relative health of these patients?
Yeah. Well, I think what I hope happens is that they get into this a medical care system that targets. Well, I'm a surgeon, so I'm interested in surgery. So it targets people who are going to have big surgical procedures, and then we put them into a program that will improve their health prior to surgery. And smoking cessation is a big part of that. And making sure that their diabetes, if they have it, making sure that's under good control. And we think progressive ambulation is a very good idea. Train, walk several miles a day. Get used to that prior to a bigger operation. There are a number of things like that we can do. Make sure they're on the proper medication beforehand so that the results are actually better.
Now, all of that sounds like the territory of a family care physician or an internist.
Well, it is, but yeah. I think we have to coordinate our efforts, surgeons and primary care.
And do you think we have enough of those primary care physicians right now to accept this new bulge of low-income patients, or are you concerned?
I'm concerned about that.
So what do you see some type of program to be initiated by the state, by healthcare systems, by physicians, societies? Where do you see this going, Doctor?
Well, that's an interesting question. And actually, the answer would surprise you. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan is our partner in trying to improve surgical care in Michigan. They've been a good partner with this and supported something that's called the Michigan Surgical Quality Collaborative, which I run. Mm-hmm. And there are now almost 70 hospitals in the state that are all connected electronically, and we get together every 3 months to talk about how to improve surgical care. And one big effort in that regard is something we call prehabilitation. That's a funny new word, but it's
Basically it's a tune-up, isn't
basically
it?
Basically a tune-up for patients, and we put them through – another way to think of it is a boot camp. We put
yes.
them through a boot camp prior to a big operation. So we say, you have to help us with this. You have to be part of this whole process to the patient. That's a very patient-centric approach. Help me to do a good job on your surgery by getting in the best shape you can possibly get into prior to surgery. So, and I think the Medicaid population could be low-hanging fruit here. There are a lot of problems they have. So a targeted strategy like I'm describing here would potentially benefit that population more so than the people who had already been in, you know, medical care and are in reasonably good shape.
Do you think seeing the data that you've come up with in this study, when you look at all these you know, many thousands of patients with the surgery and the poorer results for the Medicaid patients, do you think, for example, the state medical society could start disseminating this and making this happen throughout the state?
I absolutely do, and I think we should do that. So, because surgical costs, actually, a lot of people have surgery, and it adds a lot to the total bill for medical care in the state. So, and particularly so if the results aren't very good. So we have to, if you improve results in surgery, you cut costs, just that they go together, basically. Better quality, lower costs.
I've been speaking with the Chief Medical Officer of the University of Michigan Health System and also a surgeon, Dr. Daryl Campbell, Jr. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Our contributors today were Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sardeh, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.